The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to
discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And now to a practice embraced by the U.S. military, Google, Congressman Tim Ryan, General Mills corporate office, countless yoga teachers, and a high school in the Bronx. Mindfulness meditation. A significant body of scientific evidence shows that even limited practice improves attention and reduces stress. Brain imaging shows that long-term mindfulness training can help thicken the cortical regions associated with attention and sensory processing. We read in The Atlantic about how mindfulness meditation is being used in schools and about some of the programs now training teachers. Argos Gonzalez is one of them. He's an English teacher at the Schomburg Satellite School in the Bronx. It's a small high school for students who've dropped out or fallen behind. He's also adjunct instructor at Hunter College, where he teaches literary instruction. And Argos, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit about the Arturo Schomburg Satellite Academy. This is in the Bronx. It's a transfer school. Now, what does that mean?
So transfer school are for students who, for a lot of reasons, sometimes have to leave their old and former school. So sometimes they might look for another option so that they could graduate. So the students that come to us have sometimes been pushed out or have dropped out or have fallen behind and really just want to get their degree. So they come to us for support and help.
Now, mindfulness can be very difficult to explain even to adults. How do you introduce this concept to students?
Well, a lot of it is experiential. I ask them to take a couple of breaths with me, and then I ask them to see if it had an impact on them. And even that small act of taking a couple of breaths and pausing to pay attention to it usually sparks their interest. And then we'll kind of troubleshoot what some issues they might have when they can't really just be present in the moment, meaning, guys, you're supposed to be paying attention right now, but what are you really thinking about? Things like that. And by just bringing attention to things that happen in their life and talking about small experiences that we share together, just those two things creates a lot of buy-in for them, and then they're willing to explore it a little bit more.
What do you think are some of the things that would be on the minds of your students?
So a lot of them are worried about graduation. A lot of them are worried about, you know, their family situations, where they're going to go to work, whether they are going to have a place to stay, some of them, for the night. I mean, it really, really varies at the school that I'm in. Some students have very normal lives. They're just worried about going home to play video games or to go see their boyfriend or their girlfriend. But a lot of the students that I deal with are thinking about a lot of the things that grown-ups are thinking about, how to pay bills, how to take care of themselves and their loved ones, and how to, you know, reach their dream.
And how long and how often do you do these meditation practices in the classroom?
I have 90-minute blocks, but I don't do 90 minutes of mindfulness with them. I'll have them come in and I'll have a do now on the board. And then at some point I'll ring my singing bowl, and then we'll do like maybe a 5-minute, if that long, practice. And then we'll just talk about it and debrief for it. So at the most, we're spending 10 to 15 minutes, 3 to 5 minutes of it practicing, and the rest of the time debriefing.
And are they able to stay with it? I mean, I'm just imagining classrooms when I was in high school, you know, people passing notes or laughing or, you know, now looking at their phones.
Yeah, I mean, part of the way I've been trained is to know that participation looks different for everybody. So, you know, sometimes kids will pull out phones, sometimes kids will be doing work. And at the beginning, I just really let them know that it's okay. As long as they're not disturbing or creating noise or making it difficult for other students to participate, it's okay for them to just sit back and just take these couple of minutes to really sit and do what they feel will make them feel better. So a lot of times students don't know what to do with themselves for 2 or 3 minutes. So yeah, they'll pull out a phone or they'll pass a note or they'll giggle. But it's such a welcoming environment that I try to establish that it's okay to do that. And then we'll talk about it. They'll still be allowed to participate in the conversation that we have. And if they're comfortable, maybe even explain why they chose not to participate. So sometimes it creates for a situation where some students get self-conscious because some kids might not participate. So then I'll address that. But for the most part, it's okay. I kind of point out that if you can't really just sit still for 2 minutes, that's worth investigating.
How did you come upon this and using it in the classroom?
So I've been working in the Bronx for a number of years, and I've always had this social emotional approach because I realized early on that they needed that type of support. If I wanted them to do well in class or in school or in life thereafter, I really needed to give them some resources to deal with all the changes and feelings that they were going through. So I always kind of had this approach to being candid about my emotions and vulnerable and kind of asking them questions and then getting into the lesson. But then my wife took this training to teach yoga to children right after we had our daughter because we were having a hard time really just being present and being compassionate towards her because we were so busy and we were so tired. And, you know, raising a child can be really draining. And we were struggling because she was really strong-willed and we didn't know how to approach it so that it was we had a productive interaction rather than us just kind of getting upset and her crying. So she really got involved and she showed me a couple of things that they taught her and I decided to try them out with my students.
We're speaking with Argos Gonzalez. He is a mindful school certified instructor and English teacher in the Bronx. He's been working with his students to do mindfulness meditation in the classroom. Well, you mentioned that you're seeing results. I'm thinking about complaints that I've heard from a lot of teachers about all of their schooling is teaching to the test. It's very results oriented. Everything has to be very sort of tangible. Now, mindfulness may not be testable, but how do you see the difference in the students?
Well, for me, the ability to focus is key when we're trying to learn. So just having them focus on their breath and build up that skill set, I think, has a lot of benefits for them and their ability to just, you know, I have 90 minutes with them in a block. That's a long time to ask students to sit down and pay attention to you. You're going to find that students don't have the stamina often to pay attention that long. So by having mindful breaks or just having a mindful practice that you do at the beginning every time, you're kind of inculcating that stamina and that ability to focus. Something else that I think also supports them is that the fact that we're working on helping them regulate themselves. And a lot of times students have a lot of emotions, they have a lot of things going on, and that really gets in the way of learning. If you're worried about where you're going to get your next meal, you're not really going to be interested in the novel that I'm trying to teach you.
Is there any indication you get from them that they are putting this kind of practice to work in other parts of their lives outside of school?
Yeah, it's funny you say that because oftentimes what happens is that I'll have a student come up to me and be like, oh, my little brother was getting on my nerves and I just wanted to smack him at the side of the head. But you know what? I decided to take a breath and I kind of just smiled at him. I told him it was okay. And, you know, I didn't hit him. And that felt good to be able to do that. Or if they're at work and let's say they work at retail and they have just a customer that's just really getting on their nerves, they're just able to acknowledge that, you know, this person is getting on my nerves. But if I take a breath, I'll be able to deal with the situation in a way that will be more responsive and healthier to me, but also just kind of get this person moving on in their life too. So I'll get examples like that often from them. But sometimes also their parents will come talk to me and just tell me like, you know, I don't know, my son is now talking about this mindfulness thing. I don't know what it is, but I realized that he's a lot calmer and he's able to like have more conversations with me without losing his cool, whereas before that used to be an issue. So those are usually the main ways that I can pick up on something like that.
Well, the Bronx and New York City in general is known for, you know, being extremely diverse, having a lot of different cultures and languages spoken there. And I'm wondering if there is any resistance from families, especially to practices regarded by some as mystical or having some religious connotations. I mean, especially among Catholics and evangelicals, for example.
It's funny because that hasn't really been the issue as far as resistance goes. It hasn't usually been because it's too, they think it's spiritual or religious. Usually the resistance is more around, oh, I heard about this stuff. That stuff doesn't really work. Uh-huh. It's just a fad. They're kind of just like, oh, I don't know. No way. People have told me to take 10 breaths all the time and it has nothing for me. So what are you showing me that's going to be different? So usually the resistance is around that. But I find that these students that I work with, you know, at first, it's really hard to build trust with them because, you know, they've been in other educational institutions that maybe didn't treat them the way that they wanted to be treated. So they come here and they're just going to take care of business. They're not going to make any friends. And they just have a guard, like a big, big guard up. So getting them to trust me is sometimes difficult. But even through the mindfulness, which they are skeptical about, they find that they have these conversations that they feel good about and feel comfortable about. So then they're able to say, you know what, I'll give this a shot, even though I don't think it's going to work.
Well, Argos, you're working in one of the poorest boroughs and districts in the country, you know, with people, some of these kids have been to jail or in the foster care system, extreme economic insecurity in many, many cases. Now, you've been trained as a mindful school certified instructor. This is being used in schools in the UK and some in the US. Do you think it has applications for kids who don't have those kind of stressors, you know, the general population?
Sure. For sure. You know, I'm fortunate to eavesdrop on my wife's conversations because she gets to work with a lot of those populations. And when I'm talking to her about her experience, she tells me that, you know, everybody has struggles. They might be different struggles, but they're all struggling with wanting to feel accepted. They're all struggling with the demands that life throws their way. They're all struggling with making sure that they have a fulfilling life. So those struggles, I think, are universal in a way. And I think mindfulness supports all of that. Now, some people's struggles are harder than others, for sure. Some people's lives are more traumatic and need a bigger intervention. But I feel that everybody could use a mindfulness practice in the sense that we all have sometimes our minds running a mile a minute. Or I like to say sometimes we're on the crazy train and we know we're on the crazy train, but we don't know how to get off. We all have these experiences where we're struggling with just regulating our emotions or controlling our impulses or even just focusing at the task at hand. But I think this intervention, as simple as it is, it can be very helpful to a large variety of people.
Well, Argos, thank you so much for speaking with me. And as I say to every teacher, thank you for doing the work you do.
Oh, and thank you for having me and for continuing the conversation.
Argos Gonzalez is a mindful school certified instructor and English teacher at the Schomburg Satellite School in the Bronx. He's also an adjunct instructor at Hunter College, where he teaches literacy instruction. And you can find a link to the article from The Atlantic where we first read about Argos. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Earlier, we spoke with New York educator Argos Gonzalez about his use of mindfulness in the Bronx classroom. Mindfulness is being integrated in schools all across the country with students from all kinds of socioeconomic brackets. But does it work the same in all districts? Erin Wu is founder of the White Pine Montessori School in Bethlehem, New Hampshire. There she teaches mindfulness techniques in her classroom and in her community. So we invited her to tell us more about what mindfulness looks like in a small New Hampshire town. Erin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Give us a little bit about the background of mindfulness as it is practiced today.
Well, mindfulness has its roots in Buddhism, but as it's practiced today, it's a completely secular practice. Jon Kabat-Zinn in the late 1970s extracted some of the teachings from Buddhism and drew on some other traditions as well, but really wanted to pull it out of any kind of religious background, because he wanted to make it accessible to people who would never try going on a Buddhist retreat.
So why bring it into the classroom?
Well, when Jon Kabat-Zinn started teaching mindfulness, it was in a hospital setting. So it was a way of treating patients who were not responding well to other medical care or for whom medicine had done as much as it was going to be able to and were suffering from chronic pain or other long-term issues. So that's a great thing, but why not back it up and bring it to children as early as possible before there are these long-term health issues? as a way of fostering more happiness, more well-being, ways of dealing with the stress that children have.
Well, any particular challenges to teaching mindfulness to little ones whose, you know, brains sort of skitter around like little butterflies anyway?
Well, that's an excellent question. I teach to a variety of ages, starting with preschool all the way up through adults. So talking about the young ones, they are drawn to it. In some ways, children are more mindful than probably you or I will ever be because they are so completely in the moment. So they're kind of already there, but they don't have access to it when they need it, when it might help them. Are there challenges? Certainly. It's difficult for children when they're first learning to settle down quietly, but I find that over time that they do.
How do you get them to settle down? Tell us about some of your techniques for getting a child to participate in mindfulness meditation.
Well, if you're talking about the preschool ones that I work with, I start very slowly, but really on the first day of school, I introduce something called bubble breaths, which I learned from a yoga teacher years ago. So I bring little bottles of bubbles into the classroom, and we open them up. And, of course, children think this is wonderful because you don't blow bubbles inside. But we blow bubbles as a means of understanding that gentle breath that's required to blow a bubble and not a heavy breath that would just break the bubble before it goes out of the wand. So we blow bubbles, and then we put our wands away and we blow imaginary bubbles. And then eventually we put the pretend bottle and wand down and continue blowing breaths. And so this is just a way of starting to focus attention on the breath. And so it's kind of a playful way to bring it to children. They love make-believe things.
How about for adults, someone listening who wants to begin a mindfulness practice?
Well, I guess there would be two things I would suggest. One is that you can do it anytime, anywhere. So you could sit in a chair right in this very moment and bring your attention to your breath. You could sit upright, being comfortable, not rigid, and just bring your attention to your breath. You might feel it most strongly in your belly, your chest, in your nose. Wherever you feel it, bring your attention there. You'll probably notice that the mind wanders pretty quickly away, and this is not a problem. This is just what happens. And so each time you notice the breath has wandered is a moment of mindfulness, and this is great. So you bring the attention back. So it's this gentle process. So you could do this for a minute. You could do it for 5 minutes. It doesn't really matter. So that's one way. And then another is, I think it's really helpful to have a teacher to guide you. So this course that I mentioned that Jon Kabat-Zinn started teaching in the 1970s is still available almost anywhere in the country now at most major hospitals. It's called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, and it's a big, broad exposure with a big time commitment, but a wonderful way of learning about it.
Well, I can just feel myself slowing down listening to you.
That's great.
But a lot of people are frightened off by this idea of mindfulness meditation, you know, that it's even a word that makes them think, oh, you know, I have to think about one more thing or whatever. One of the ways that I've heard it described is just paying attention. Does that work for you?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, so pay attention. That's a great idea. But then the next moment, the mind is off and wandering. So in some ways, to say pay attention can feel like, okay, it's one more thing. How do I pay attention, as you say? I don't even have time as it is now, and I keep forgetting. So I guess there's this big part of mindfulness which holds compassion as a big part of it. And so can I be compassionate and understand that my life is as it is and that I'm very busy? I live in a culture that's moving at a very fast pace. And can I just take the moments as they come? Because we can't force ourselves to be mindful. But if we set this intention of, yes, this is something I want to move toward, little by little, those moments will start to increase. Just setting this intention, I want to be mindful, is a huge part of it.
Well, you've been practicing this for some time. There are now teams at Google who are doing mindfulness meditation. General Mills has made it part of its practice. Tim Ryan, the congressman, has his staff do it. And there is some criticism about this idea that it makes you more functional, you know, selling it as you'll do better at business or in your life, you'll be more successful. Is mindfulness meditation at risk of getting a bad name as some kind of hokey fad?
Well, I think there certainly is the risk of that. And I guess I feel two ways about it. On the one hand, yes, it can get watered down and it can be seen as this quick fix and as a fad. And when that happens, I think it does a disservice to the overall understanding of what mindfulness is. But that said, people at Google learning how to take a breath in their lives and focus more, I don't see that as really problematic. I think it's great that so many people know of it now and are interested in learning more.
Well, thank you for pausing with us today.
Well, thank you. I very much enjoyed talking with you.
Erin Wu, she's founder of the White Pine Montessori School. That's in Bethlehem, New Hampshire. And you can find more about MBSR, including a link to see Erin's TEDx talk. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Now that Labor Day is past, we can safely say that the song of the summer for 2015, at least according to the numbers, is Cheerleader by Omi. So what's next? The song for fall? Well, after the annual fervor to find out what the big summer jam is going to be and discovering the hit holiday song, autumn seems positively forgotten. So we wanted to figure out what a fall anthem might sound like and to discuss some seasonal trends in the music industry. So we've assembled a little panel to talk it over. Joining me is Carl Wilson, the music critic for Slate, Maura Johnston, music critic and editor of Maura Magazine, and Alex Gale, senior editor at Billboard, which I understand all you guys have met each other digitally. Is this the first time you've actually all talked?
Yeah.
No.
Very exciting.
Maura and I know each other.
Oh, yeah, Carl and I have met.
Okay, Alex, you're the outlier then. Welcome.
I am. It's because I never leave the office, so I only meet people digitally. It's very sad.
Well, I'm glad to have you all with us. And Alex, before we get into the Song of the Fall, how is it that Billboard anoints the Song of the Summer?
Well, we've been doing it for years now, and we basically go from Memorial Day to Labor Day, and we take, without getting too boring and nerdy, the Hot 100 chart points. So, you know, we look at digital sales, streaming on YouTube and Spotify and elsewhere, and radio. And, you know, each of those things are weighted a certain way. And the song with the most points in that time period is number one. And, yeah, Cheerleader kind of was a dark horse that beat out Wiz Khalifa and Charlie Puth, See You Again. And, yeah, it's a very summery song. It's kind of not that much of a surprise. It was pretty inescapable, so.
So that's all behind us now.
Yes, yes. It's time to listen to sad fall music. So.
Well, if we weren't going to go off the Billboard charts, what other kind of criteria do you think help makes this seasonal song, the song of the summer in this case? Any choices for you, alternate choices for you, Maura?
I was a big fan of Trap Queen by Fetty Wap.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a song that I definitely heard. My criteria for a song of the summer is always, am I hearing it coming out of cars? And I definitely heard Cheerleader coming out of a lot of cars up here in Boston this summer. But Trap Queen was also a very popular choice for people who rolled their windows down and turned their volume up really loud. And then as sort of a late contender, and, you know, it almost is cheating because it uses the name of the season in the title, but I was a big fan of Demi Lovato's Cool for the Summer as well. Take me down into your paradise. Don't be scared, cause I'm your body type. Just something that we wanna try. Cause you and I, we're cool for the summer.
Well, Alex, you said that you guys have been doing this for years at Billboard. When did the summer song become a thing?
You know, maybe about 10 or 15 years ago is when we really started trumpeting it more. I think just the internet, honestly, is part of it too. it's the end of the summer. There's not a lot of music coming out, and people are looking for something to write about, honestly. So I think that's one way that it started to get trumpeted, because everyone was kind of talking about their songs of summer. But, hey, here we have an actual official list with hard data that can – quote-unquote, prove what the Song of Summer is.
Yeah, well, everyone's on our way for, on vacation. The rest of the staff puts together the Song of the Summer.
Yep.
Well, summer is this kind of shared experience, though. At least, you know, school is out in Los Angeles and Des Moines and New York. But fall is very specific. I mean, fall doesn't really feel like fall in California, for example. So it's another feeling.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think that there is an abstract idea of fall that we share. But you know, it's funny because I think the Song of the Summer has become kind of an overhyped category in the past 5 or 6 years, particularly. And this summer was weird because really, I would say that nothing really dominated the way that, you know, look back to the year of Call Me Maybe, that, you know, the way that that kind of dominated. But there's this kind of obligatory notion to it now. And there's kind of a relief, I think, when that sweepstakes is over and everybody goes back to school or work or where whatever they're going to. And in some ways, we do kind of retreat back into our more, you know, individual shells and silos and experience things more on the basis of those specific experiences rather than this kind of generalized idea of, you know, beaches and cars with the top down.
So what should then the criteria be for a song of the fall if we were going to ignore the charts?
With school starting, I mean, I teach at Boston College in addition to writing. And so school has sort of been, you know, the driving force in my life for the past 2 weeks. And there's a sense of sort of getting more serious. There's a sense of, you know, buckling down and also getting into the memories of fall's past, of school year's beginning, of new starts, of the, and then the thought about, you know, the sunsets getting earlier. And the sort of idea of night sort of creeping in and taking over. So for me, the songs that I thought about, you know, when I thought of songs of the fall, I think of a lot of songs that have sort of slower beats, more kind of like chiming pianos, you know, fuzzed out guitars. And then actually the pop song that I really like for this fall is one that I think from the start, it's actually from a record that many people said was a really good summer album, but I feel like this one song, because it has this kind of nighttime feel, really encapsulates how fall can be a time of transition and life getting a little tougher and a little colder, and that's Making the Most of the Night by Carly Rae Jepsen from her new album Emotion.
Let's hear a little bit of that. So Carly Rae Jepsen, Making the Most of the Night, Maura Johnson's pick for a song for the fall. And Maura, you talked a little bit about going back to school. I mean, I think there's this deep nostalgia many of us as adults feel about the fall. But what else makes a fall song? I'm thinking moodiness, you know, pumpkin-related lyrics. What makes it?
Well, for me, it's baseball, too. You know, definitely anything that you can sort of glom onto the pennant race works for a fall song for me. But I think there is, there's a sense of moodiness. I mean, that song, even though it does reference kind of the ocean and everything, it is in this context where you think you get the feeling they're driving there, you know, when the beach is empty and they have to sneak on. For me, fall is all about a new start. You know, you get a new book bag, you get a new pair of boots, you kind of buckle down and get serious about learning German or whatever you want to do as a project, even if you're not in school for it.
You're reminding me of those like 60s genre records, music to pack your book bags by, or to learn German by. Yeah. How about you, Carl or Alex? Any picks for you for the Song of the Fall?
Well, I think I identify a lot with what Maura's talking about, but I think in addition for me in the fall, I think partly just as a person and also to some extent as a music critic, there's a feeling of retreat and regret and the end of summer, the sense of something is closing down. And it does bring up that kind of more nostalgic and ruminative kind of feeling, along with that kind of twilight feeling that Maura was talking about. And I think I tend to retreat to kind of more singer-songwritery kind of material in the fall. I think, you know, the Carly Rae record has a lot of nice things that feel that way. There's the new album by Destroyer from Vancouver, Poison Season, which is almost a perfect title for a fall album, and that just came out at the end of August as well. And there's a song that appears on that album in sort of different iterations at the beginning, in the middle, and the end, called Times Square, which really calls up that sense of looking around wistfully, and you can almost sort of hear leaves blowing around, and there's this sense of all of the characters in the song sort of looking before them and behind them and wondering where they're headed. And there's something very autumnal about that to me.
Well, let's listen to that. This is Destroyer, Times Square.
Artist and repertoire, hand in hand through the great away at dawn. The writing on the wall said Jesus saved. On the wall mentions honey playing a game with the waves. You can follow a rose wherever it grows, so you could fall in love with Times Square. Times Square.
Carl, I have to say, I am so with you on this sort of glass half empty aspect of fall. You know, I see it as this kind of time to become internal and not the beginning of a new season, but sort of the end of something. And what I hear in that song, it's like, I don't know, Ziggy Stardust. I hear a lot of David Bowie in that song.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a quality of that in his vocal style. Although I think there's, you know, there's also kind of a Bruce Springsteen kind of early 80s kind of feeling with the saxophones and the guitar solos and that kind of thing, that kind of deliberately unfashionable in a certain way, that also seems to me to speak to a more interior sense, which is kind of ironic given the sort of broad sounds of that time.
We're talking about the song of the fall and seasonal trends in the music industry and our listening habits. Joining me, Carl Wilson, who we just heard from, Maura Johnston, and also Billboard senior editor Alex Gale. Alex, you're our numbers guy here. What do you think the song of the fall is going to be?
Honestly, what I do think right now is obviously the favorite to be the song of the fall. It's not my personal favorite necessarily, but it would be Justin Bieber, What Do You Mean? I mean, it's already number one right now, and it has a little bit of a vibe of like going back to work, which Bieber kind of is. It's a little more serious than some summer songs would be. It just has a little more of a serious vibe. It's already number one, so obviously that would be the heavy favorite to sort of be the popular pick for Song of Fall. My pick would be actually a song by Churches, and it's interesting to me that Maura had a song from Carla Rae Jepsen, because they're a little bit of a similar sound. Churches is sort of a alt-pop, synth-pop group, and they have a great song called Never Ending Circles. And they're from Glasgow, and they have sort of a windy, windswept, sad fall sound. But there's a little bit of hope to it and a little bit of drive to it, because maybe this is a very New York and like sort of magazine view. But when I look at fall, I'm also like, okay, it's getting colder, but I'm also, I might be a little sad that summer's over, but I'm also focused and I'm going to get down to work.
Let's hear that. Churches, Never Ending Circles. You know, I hear that song and I think about
Well, it's got a vibe of another era, certainly. But also for me, it's not just what's coming out this fall. It's thinking of fall's past. There is a particular kind of feeling. I wonder if any of you have picks of music that you listen to or turn to over and over again that kind of says fall to you.
In the past, the fall has also meant new seasons of college radio a lot for me, like coming back to the college radio fold and finding all the, you know, a lot of new releases. So I have a strong sort of like pull toward indie pop of various stripes, particularly the more languorous and sad type. And one of the songs that I always think of when I think of the fall is from the Olivia Tremor Control's 1996 album Dusk at Cuba's Castle. It's called Marking Time, and there's something about the piano, which is this really kind of beautifully off-kilter piano that runs throughout the song, that really just makes me think of, you know, the days getting shorter and the leaves sort of giving way to bare branches.
Let's hear a little bit of that. This is Marking Time, the Olivia Tremor Control.
Did you ever see the light inside my window?
Alex, is there a song that you turn to? You know, your sort of fall song?
Well, I definitely think there's a lot of nostalgia there. And for me, when I'm a kid, one of my favorite music moments was opening up Tribe Called Quest album, The Low End Theory, which came out the fall of 1991, you know, unwrapping the cassette, because that's what I had, and playing the first song on there is called Excursions, and it just, like, starts with just, like, an acoustic jazz bass line, no beat, and then Q-Tip just with this really kind of indelible, unforgettable verse. And it's just a classic album, and I think I sat there and, you know, just listened to that whole album all the way through probably like 5 times, and I still do that today.
Back in the days when I was a teenager, before I had status and before I had a pager, you can find the abstract listening to hip hop. My pops used to say it reminded him of bebop. I said, well, daddy, don't you know that things go in cycles? Way the Bobby Brown is just amping like Michael. It's all expected, things are for the looking. If you got the money, Quest is for the booking. Come on, everybody, let's get with the fly mode. Still got room on the truck.
Alex, does the music industry release albums strategically like a movie studio? You know, do they think, this is a really summery record to increase the chances of winning a Grammy or making a hit?
They do somewhat. For songs, they actually do think somewhat about what can work for different seasons. For Ariana Grande's last album, Republic actually told us in an article that I think she had something like four, maybe even 5 singles, and they really planned them out by each season. Okay, this one's kind of a summery one. This one's good for fall. This one maybe has more of a holiday vibe to it. But the more important consideration is usually just like the fourth quarter's coming up and we need to hit our bottom line. So if we have an album by Adele, for example, or Kanye or Beyonce, to name some of the big albums that are probably coming up this quarter, they're going to put them out in the fourth quarter where more people are shopping, and then all of a sudden they have a profit for 2015.
Alex Gale, senior editor at Billboard, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And Carl Wilson, he's music critic for Slate. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Moore Johnston, music critic and editor of Mora Magazine, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.
What do you think the song of the fall ought to be? Is there something qualitatively different about a good summer jam and an autumn anthem? You can share your thoughts on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. For me, it's a whole album, and I do say album, that I retreat to over and over again in the fall, Neutral Milk Hotel's In the Airplane Over the Sea.
And one day we will die, and our ashes will fly from the aeroplane. But for now, we are young. Let us lay in the sun.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sometimes a hit song lasts for a season, and sometimes a track stays with you for years. Every now and again, there is a piece of music that moves you, that digs into your psyche, and changes the way you think about the world. Song Story is a project that invites people to recollect those moments. In this episode, filmmaker Carrie Kandel remembers how a single composition changed the trajectory of his life.
In my late 20s, I was driving from Los Angeles to Santa Barbara up the 1 freeway. Beautiful, beautiful setting. Ocean to the left, beautiful clouds in the air. I was in a car that a friend had lent me, a black Fiat, and it was back in the cassette days. I pushed the cassette in, and this music came out that was stunning. And remember, I loved rock and roll like most of the people of my generation, the Beatles, the Stones, the Kinks, the Who, Dylan. I loved that music and had no knowledge of classical music, but when I pushed this cassette in, this remarkable music came out. It was so serene and beautiful. And then later on, just lit up the sky with this incredible power and majesty. This music was Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and it transformed my life. I fell in love with this music at the moment that I heard it, and then had to go on and listen more, become a Beethoven fanatic, and as I tell people, I wanted to walk the streets of my neighborhood with little pamphlets and hand them out to people and ask them if they had Beethoven in their lives. I became a Beethoven's witness. It transformed my life in a way that required that I go out and listen to more of Beethoven's music. I read his biographies, I started reading scholarly work on his pieces, and started thinking about the Ninth. And when the Google came along, as John McCain called it, I started getting Google alerts about the Ninth Symphony, so I got everything that came in about Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. So I found out these stories that were happening around the globe with this piece that was, of course, sort of a universal anthem of brotherhood and sisterhood and connecting across all borders. The famous line in the fourth movement of the Ninth Symphony, the Ode to Joy, Alle Menschen werden Brüder, all men will be brothers. And another line that said, this is a kiss for all the world. Beethoven sent this music out for all humanity. As I started finding out about the music being used at Tiananmen Square in 1989, or in Pinochet's Chile, where women sang the Ode to Joy as they marched on prisons where people were being tortured and men inside heard it, and in Japan, where 5,000, 10,000 people sang this Ode to Joy in a chorus, in Germany, when the wall came down in 1989, when Leonard Bernstein performed the Ninth Symphony in Berlin. I thought I just had to make a movie about this experience, this music, Beethoven himself, and its global impact. And I went on to make this film called Following the Ninth, and that too has changed my life for the better. So thank you, Beethoven. I'm keeping with you. I'm listening still. You're still changing my life in different ways, rearranging the molecules in my heart and brain. I wish you were here to see the film.
The filmmaker Carrie Kandel there. His film, Following the Ninth, was released in 2013. And that piece was part of Song Story. That's a project that invites listeners to record a story about a tune that changed their lives. You'll find a link to the website where you can learn more about how you can submit your own song story. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Now that, and I'm afraid I'm going to say this out loud, summer is drawing to a close, we're asking you for your picks for 2015 Song of the Fall. There's lots of good music to choose from. New albums from Ben Folds and Beru out last week. More from Lana Del Rey and a bunch of other great artists still to come. You can share your fall anthem on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or by calling our listener line at 603-223-2448.
That's 223-2448. And help us broaden the discussion by sharing the show with your friends. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us tomorrow, too, for more Word of Mouth, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.